the Buddha, there's the Dharma, there's the Sangha. I was going to kind of rush through the chapter on the Eightfold Path, and I'm glad that I didn't, because it's just this incredible little treasury of teaching in there. It's just a reminder, there's absolutely nothing in this book that isn't both incredibly profound and also really exquisite, really beautiful. The Master talked about right understanding. I was reading about that. Now we get to the second step of the Eightfold Path, which is right thought. And she says, this is naturally the child of right understanding. And then she just says something amazing about it that you'd never think of. I mean, you'd never think of this. But listen to this. When the understanding is true, capital T, italicized, true. True is really, means deep truth, in harmony with deep truth. When the understanding is true, the thoughts become reality to the extent of taking shape and color, thus confirming the rightness of the understanding. But I must not cling to that shape and color any more than I must cling to emptiness. Go in and out, we were told. And then she quotes from Kazan, sometimes I raise the eyebrows of old Shakyamuni Buddha and sometimes I do not. She says these two sayings are the same. We live in the world as if in the sky is as this. And here, this is a place where she's clearly linking the visions that she's been having to the step of the Eightfold Path, right thought. And so I just want to give a little kind of doctrinal background. One thing, the Rim Master was really steeped in Buddhist teaching. She started in London when she was a young woman with Dr. Sadatisa, who was a very fine Theravadan teacher. She studied with him, and you know they're really great on the doctrine. She really learned the teachings. So she's expressing something here that it's different from a Western way of thinking of thought. We kind of think of perception and thought as being two things, but in Buddhism, it's kind of perception slash thought. I've talked about this before, you know, years ago. And here she's saying, listen to what she's saying, that if the understanding is right, if you're rooted in true faith, if you're rooted in true faith, and your understanding is developing out of true faith, think in terms of process, of development of something. If your understanding is developing out of true faith, if your understanding is the realization of the potential that is in faith, you know, true faith gives true spiritual certainty. So if the understanding is developing out of true faith, then the thought processes will come into alignment. The way that we think, the way we perceive things will come into alignment with that faith as well. And again, if we go back to, well, what is the faith? The faith is just that knowing without knowing that is inherent in all of us. That little inextinguishable light of understanding. The faith is actually a kind of understanding, but it's not a head understanding. It's a heart understanding that there is the eternal. And that there is a goodness that lies beyond good and evil as the world thinks of them. And that there is love, even when there does not seem to be love. Something in us always knows this, and faith is holding fast to that. If we're holding fast to that, then, if we're holding fast to that in our daily life, then, which is the whole purpose of, you know, meditation and the religious life, then it's like the rest of the Eightfold Path comes scrolling out of that. And you have the development of the right understanding, the certainty of the eternal. of the inextinguishable love of the eternal. And then out of that, you have thought and perception coming into alignment with the eternal. This is the Eightfold Path, from the deep understanding of harmonization with the eternal. Need getting its help from the eternal, converting into merit, the whole thing circulating. Now the eternal's in the driver's seat, not the selfish I. I've often thought of a statement that River Master said, when I was still a pretty young monk, and I don't remember whether she said it before 76, after 76, or during, but if it was after, it was not long after, I don't think. I was still quite young. I remember her saying once, I only ever heard her say it once, she said, imagination is a monk's best friend and a monk's worst enemy. So let's just kind of think of what she's saying in that light here. Think of when you have like turbulent dreams that are very, very, as Rim Basil and I like to say, karmatoid. You know, that the karma is strongly active, and you have these dreams with fear and anxiety and worry and, think of those kind of dreams where the karma is very active. It's as if when you're asleep, your imagination is being kind of taken over by the karma almost. And you're being kind of having a little kind of horror show. You know, it's like your imagination is like the screen on which the karma is being projected. And then, and this is really my experience, that when, as over the years, as training deepens and as one harmonizes more with the eternal, actually that element in the dreams goes away. And instead, dreams become more, not always, but often more, that there's actually teaching in them. And that one wakes up and one realizes it. Sometimes strikingly so. It's the same basic capacity of imagination that's being used. The screen's the same. It's just that what's being projected on the screen is different because conversion has been happening. Now let's expand it beyond sleep to 24 hours, the waking day as well. And if I understand what Ramaster's saying here, she's saying, well, this makes the visions make sense. It's the eternal at the controls of thought and perception giving you teachings. Again, I'd caution, I always say this, don't think it's just that or just anything. But it's a helpful way of looking at it, and it seems to be the way she's talking about it here. You know, we're all familiar with at least hearing about cases where people are psychotic and think they're hearing voices, sometimes the voice of God, sometimes the voice of the devil, sometimes maybe the voice of Jerry, I don't know. But, Jerry, get out of my head. But, someone's voice, telling them to do things. And they're usually actually not very nice things when that's happening. And it's really important to remember, no, the Lord will never break the precepts. If you're being told to break the precepts, that ain't the eternal. You need to tell it to go sit and not follow those. And also, the eternal doesn't ever order you, do this, do that. It's another thing. A lot of people who are psychotic, they think that they're being ordered to do these things, that they have to comply. But that's just delusion, And yet, it's the same basic screen again. And where there was such delusion, that if such delusion can be projected onto the screen, why not enlightenment? Instead of, hallucinating, seeing, things that aren't there, one might have visions and see things that might not be there to most people, but they're actually revealing the actual true nature of things. This isn't as special to religion as it might seem, because when you read the story of great scientific discoveries, sometimes it sounds a bit like this. People sometimes talk about they sweated over some problem for ages and ages, and then one day it was just given to them. And they'll talk about like I was not the agent of it. It just came, and it's like it was just in my mind's eye. So what would she mean if she said that imagination is a monk's best friend and a monk's worst enemy? I wondered about that for so many years. But of course, events that happened in this temple some years ago really showed it, what it can mean, where someone went briefly, very delusional and thought that things were happening that weren't happening. And that's where imagination is your worst enemy. And we help that individual get regrounded in just daily life and meditation done properly. At least at that time, there were difficulties later, but at least at that time. But this was a good example of it. Imagination becoming your worst enemy because you just kind of like give your will over to the karma and what do you expect is going to happen? So you always have to stand up to the karma when it's getting pushy. Remember, you have your own will and you are not your karma. You're you. You may not be too clear about what you are, but sometimes you can know what you're not. And the karma can't control you unless you give your will to it. And it's an illusion to think that it's kind of taking charge. Now people can get very confused. So obviously, imagination can be your worst enemy. If imagination is kind of running rampant, you've got to rein it in and get yourself grounded. Meditation and just ordinary daily life. Well, actually, interestingly enough, one of the best things you can do to help yourself when that's happening, if that ever starts to happen, is just like go out and do some gardening, get your hands in the soil. And Rim Master used to have us do that at times when things were really rocky. Just do a whole bunch of garden work, that kind of thing. And it does reground you. It helps, tremendous help. Then imagination can be your best friend if the Eternal takes it over and helps you with by that means. You see? So, willful use of the imagination, bad idea. The Eternal using it to help us, great, no problem. There's a beautiful line, I can't remember where it is, but it's in some of the writings on reharmonization that Rim Master shared with us. And One of the things that's always stuck in my mind is this line, something along these lines: the forms shaped by the spirit fire come up empty color and form. And this is what she's saying here. If you read this. But I must not cling to that shape and color any more than I must cling to emptiness itself. But all experiences, by their very nature, are transitory. And this transitoriness is an essential component of what we call emptiness in Buddhism. That all things are transitory. It's one aspect. The other aspect is the aspect so many... So much of the time that that people in Buddhism don't emphasize is eternity. To truly penetrate the teaching of changeableness thoroughly and truly and deeply reveals the eternal. It's the other side of it. That all of our experience is transitory, and there is that which we know with our heart, which is not, but which is not part of our perceptual experience. It only manifests through it. So this is as true of visions as anything else. All the teachings are transitory. That from which they come, that from which truth comes, is not transitory. And again, this is not like philosophical. This is something that we know, and that the eternal is that within which we can take refuge in. It's not just a kind of abstraction. She goes on to say, right thought is as the stem of the lotus coming forth from the root of right understanding. Without that stem, the plant is useless. Although hidden by the water, I know it is there if a flower is visible. Without it, the flower will die. Just as there can be no stem without a root, so there can be no flower without a stem. Unseen, both root and stem may be, but if there is a blossom, I know they are both there. If the blossom is always young and beautiful, I know that the root and stem are healthy. Now, what's she talking about here? The basic thing that makes up right thought is often not at the forefront and the most visible. It's an attitude. It's the attitude of rootedness, that comes from rootedness in the truth of immaculacy. There is nothing from the first. Since there is nothing from the first, the sixth patriarch's poem went, where can the dust alight? There is no real evil. There is just that which is seeking, that needs, and will one day get conversion. When we dwell within right thought, which comes again from right understanding, which the root of which is faith, we see things in this way and we respond accordingly in our speech and action. And since all of our actions, all of our volitional actions, the way we make karma, you know, all of it comes from our thought, originates in our thought. It's really important where we're acting from, the place from which we're acting. And it's not just thought and the way we tend to. Everything in the Western culture gets very brain-oriented, and with the prevalence of computers nowadays, even more so. We tend to think of thoughts as like sentences of words and that kind of thing. But you could say right thought is right attitude. Right mental orientation. That's right thought. So is thought rooted in the heart, in the Buddha nature, or is it just rooted in a bunch of goofiness? That's the question. As Dogen said, you know, if your first step is false, you'll immediately stumble. Get it right at the wellspring. Because further down the line, it's harder to get it right. The blossom that comes forth from right thought is the exhibiting of enlightenment in our daily life. right thought is not exhibited for the world to see. You can be thinking all kinds of things in your head, and it's a private matter mostly. See? And inevitably, where our attitude is off, it will get expressed eventually in speech and action. Just the way it works. And the meaning of that, you know, see, one of the meanings of that wonderful saying of Kazan's, you know, sometimes I raise the eyebrows of old Shakyamuni and sometimes I do not, is it's a cautionary remark, you know, cautionary observation. No one gets it right all the time. So be mindful. Be mindful of where your speech and your actions are coming from. And don't abdicate your responsibility based on some formula of morality. You know, the first principle of morality from a religious point of view, a deep religious point of view, is I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in my own heart. She goes on to say, and what of the bud of the lotus, right speech? Just as right thought comes out of right understanding, so is right speech the child of right thought. When the thought is wrong, the speech becomes lying, coarse, irreverent, worrisome, and incredible. That's a great description, you know, if you think about it. We start evading truth and get squirrely. I'd put all of that under the heading of squirrely speech. You know, we're no longer upright in our speech. We're evasive. When the stem becomes diseased because something has attacked the root, the lotus bud withers and dies. What's the root? Faith. Yeah, over and over again she stresses in this the importance of the faith. When faith is impaired, gratitude and joy die. That really is true. This helps explain how people can be doing so well at one moment and do this amazing flip if they start running with the karma, the old karmic tendencies, the old habit energy, the karma. And it explains how people can do such a 180 degree flip sometimes, where they were expressing gratitude at one point and, you know, the next moment, you know, they're blaming. And the scary thing, of course, is that we all have that capacity. If we neglect the root, we let our faith get damaged, it's amazing how fast we start running down the old tracks and how it always ends up being someone else's fault, you know. You know, Buddhism teaches responsibility for ourselves. It's not someone else's fault. If I'm breaking the precepts, it's not someone else's fault. Only one person can break the precepts for me, and that's me. Says, when faith is impaired, gratitude and joy die. Thoughts become unreal. God, that's just great teaching. Thoughts become unreal. You even have this feeling when this happens of like your kind of your head starting to kind of separate from the rest of you and lose its grounding. I've actually had that feeling when I was in the presence of delusion sometimes. It's like literally feeling torn in two. The head saying, oh, well, that makes sense. But the heart saying, watch out, yikes. And then if you go with the head, then the thoughts really, truly become unreal. They've lost their grounding in true reality, and they're off in the realm of delusion. Worldly thought is delusory. She says, duality arises, and then there can be no trusting the speech of others, let alone that of oneself. And that's what happens. That's exactly what happens. We don't know what's true and what isn't. We've lost the connection between our brain and our heart. We lose that connection. Then the brain just kind of runs amok looking for the answers in all the wrong places. Looking for external proofs of what the heart knows, or external disproofs. And it can't be done that way. It can't be done that way. There's that saying, I wish I had a more literal memory, because I remember some of these things, and I actually can't remember actually how it goes, but it's something along the lines of, for someone who's doubting, no proof will ever be enough. For someone who has faith, no proof is necessary. And that is really true. At the deepest level, that is really true. That is really true. It's amazing how just your way of seeing someone and their actions can change so radically when you are swamped by doubt. And how different it is when the doubt's not present. I got a stern education in that, in the kind of middle period of my training. And fortunately, I came through that. That's something one always has to watch. We always have to guard that root of faith. Guard it for dear life. You know, I'm Reverend Master's disciple, and that for part of that, an important part of that for me, an essential part of it, is I always have to guard my faith in her teaching, which in the very heart of which is Lotus Blossom here. And I have to say once again, as I said a number of times in these talks, it's just been an immense joy for me in doing these talks to just again and again have this massive sense of confirmation of the truth of every word of what's in this book. And not some remote truth, but it's so much of it I've found just true for me. It's taking on faith, and it's also experience. And part of that experience has just actually come in the course of this seemingly interminable series of talks, which I'm trusting, I'm going on faith here, that it's not interminable. This talk is terminated.